call the Civil Law Committee to order. Members, we got just a quick housekeeping item on prior minutes. It turns out that representative or the persons that were excused also showed up as present in the minutes based on the way they got done on the program. So the chair is going to move that we approve the substitute minutes for the first two meetings of the Civil Law Committee. If there's any questions, members? Otherwise, chair will move that motion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Representative Holberg moves the approval of the minutes of Monday, January 24th. Any discussion on those minutes? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion passes. Members, today we first got Professor Versteeg from William Mitchell College of Law. She was one of the presenters last week at the William Mitchell Forum or Seminar, Law School for Legislators. We've asked her to come in and do a similar presentation for the committee, anticipating we will try to get into some family law issues in the near future. I thought it would be a good background and good insight for us as committee members interested in this issue, knowing it's a topic that doesn't always have a right and wrong answer, but we have to make judgment calls, and the more information we can get, I think the better. And then Molly Olson will follow up after her with some additional testimony on the joint custody issue that many have heard about, and then we will, with what time allows, start a hearing on House File 203. That's kind of the roadmap for today. Professor Versteeg, if you want to come first and identify yourself for the record, welcome to the Civil Law Committee, and we appreciate your making time for us and being able to come and present and answer questions that I'm guessing the committee will have.
Thank you. I'm Professor Nancy Versteeg. I'm the Vice Dean and a professor of law at William Mitchell College of Law in St. Paul, and I'm delighted to be here today. I appreciate your invitation, and I especially appreciate your attention to these really important issues. I don't think there are any easy answers in a lot of the issues that you deal with, and so I'm hoping to provide, I hope, some helpful background and context as you grapple with them. I provided you with a few handouts. One is has copies of a few of the statutes that I'm just going to mention. You may already have these, but a PowerPoint slide can't do them justice, and I thought you might want to see the actual language. Just a quick whirlwind tour of the definitions in Minnesota family law, and we have two kinds of custody as we define them. And there are permutations of these as well. Legal custody, the right to determine the child's upbringing, education, health care, religious training. I think of this as the board of directors of parenting, making those big policy kinds of decisions on behalf of kids. The other important definition is physical custody and residence, which has to do with the routine daily care and control residence of the child. So we talk about that loosely as physical custody, where the child actually is, who's in charge at that point in time. All Minnesota cases are going to have some designation in some way, shape, or form about both of those issues. But in addition, we, of course, have opportunities for people to have joint legal custody, meaning they share decision-making about those important issues like education and religion. And also joint physical custody, which means that they share, the child lives at each of the homes for various periods of time. And in our law, that's not defined as a certain period of time or a certain amount of time, but it is really talking about that is structured between the parents, that care. And that's an important definition, which I'll come back to, because some people assume that joint physical custody means 50-50 time, and some people assume it means 30-70 or whatever it might be. And in our legal definition, it can be a variety of times. So I think when people talk about joint physical custody, they probably usually mean a substantial sharing of time, but the legal definition doesn't always track that. We currently make most of the child custody decisions that are made by courts anyway, using, here's another one, parenting time, which is the time that parents spend with kids regardless of the custodial definition. This used to be thought of as visitation of kids. We don't use that term anymore. I'll talk about that in a minute, or we don't use it very often anyway. But parenting time would be time that either parent would spend with kids. And if there is a designated, you know, non-residential parent, it would certainly refer to time spent there. The primary framework for our decisions that courts make about child custody are based on the best interest standard. And I, one slide can't do this justice, so I've provided you with a copy of that statute. But basically, it involves a number of factors that courts look at, and it involves an individual look at each child that comes before the court for that kind of determination. So it's an individual determination. It's really focused on the needs of the kids. Certainly, you know, the parents' interests are involved in that, but the primary focus is on the kids. The best interests of kids, of course, can change over time. So a one-year-old, what is in their best interest may look different than a 17-year-old. So it's a flexible kind of concept that we use, and a number of other states use it. It's not perfect, and we have certainly always situations where it depends heavily on the decision-making of the judge. It depends on what information comes before the court, if this even goes to court. And so there is discretion on the part of courts. That's also its strength, of course, because they can look at the individual family, hear from the people, look in their eyes, think about the credibility of folks, and look at information about each individual child. So it's always a challenge, I think, for courts to do that. And certainly, we have many great judges in this state who take that very seriously. I can't say that they never make a mistake, but that's why we have an appellate process. A step back in history here for a minute. As a professor, you know, we like to talk about the history of family law, and it's very interesting. You didn't used to be able to get divorced in Minnesota by going to court. You had to get the legislature to divorce you. Way back when. Domestic violence used to be legal. And we've had a number of child custody arrangements, which is my point here, over time. In the 1800s, custody almost always went to the father. There was a paternal presumption. That switched almost completely around by the 1930s, and there was a maternal presumption, and custody almost always went to the mother. By the 60s and 70s, people were increasingly uncomfortable with that gender notion of that's how we decide who gets custody. And the legislature adopted the best interest standard, started looking at much more gender neutral. What does this child need? Who can provide what for the child, as opposed to having the automatic designation? Family court has changed dramatically in the last 30 or 40 years, and we refer to this, you know, in law review articles as the family law revolution. And it happened big time in Minnesota and is still continuing today. And I think explains a little bit of how these issues are so complicated and there's so many different forces in play. But we've had a lot of court reform in the past few years, less statutory reform, although a fair amount, and I'll talk about that too. So some things that have caused all this change and upheaval in the court system, and there have been some very positive changes resulting, but it's a lot of change in a short period of time. Issues about resources for courts, and I'm sure that you hear and will hear more about those. In the family law area, a very important dynamic is the large increase in parents who are not represented by lawyers. Because I think we think of people in court, each one having a lawyer, they each tell their story, there's this balanced playing field idea. Facts come before the court makes a decision. But what's changed since especially the 1980s is that nationally, 80 to 90% of family law cases involve at least one unrepresented party. So it's relatively unusual to have both parties represented, and that's changed the way courts do business. Parents also became really unhappy with the family court system and started to express that, saying that it escalated conflict, that there wasn't enough focus on the kids, that the process wasn't helping them. And courts have taken that to heart. So some major changes also in society, I'll talk about these just for a minute. We used to have what we called the clean break theory, which was at the time of divorce, family split apart, kids formed a new family unit, and the parent who wasn't the residential or custodial parent was kind of supposed to fade out of the picture to some extent. Now, that's an extreme view of it, but this clean break theory was very prevalent. That has certainly gone by the wayside, and I think we've had a large swing toward, and it's supported by social science research, that it's best for most kids, not every kid, but for most children, to have ongoing contact with both parents after divorce. Okay, this is a big change in the family law system from what it was 50 years ago. That was not, did not used to be such a strong goal. We consequently have stopped focusing so much on win-lose, who wins custody, who loses custody, but rather on restructuring relationships so the kids can have the best that both parents can offer. This is easy to say and somewhat harder to do. There's large empirical consensus among social scientists and child psychologists that ongoing conflict is harmful to kids. You know, most kids do well after divorce. I'm constantly amazed by the efforts that parents go to really help kids do well. And it actually is comforting to some parents to know that how they handle the divorce process can help strengthen the odds for their kids. And every couple, I think, that gets divorced certainly experiences conflict. So we're not saying that, you know, everybody's harmed by low levels of conflict. I'm talking about the kind of conflict that goes on and goes on sometimes for years. Where parents are always disagreeing and disagreeing about important things. So this sets up an interesting dynamic because we're saying we want kids to have more contact with both parents. We want parents to really keep the conflict level down. Well, how do we do that? They're having more contact and they're supposed to have less conflict. It's a challenging task. So our goals for our system have changed quite a bit. At the same time, a strong movement toward family self-determination. And a lot of the new processes for divorce really strengthen that. This idea that families often know what's better for them, that they may come before a judge for 10 minutes or for 2 days, and that judge can't possibly know everything about the family that the family knows. And so the idea is to empower families to help them make the best decisions that they can make for themselves, to give them some flexibility to change those as they go along. And that's a change from how it used to be. So we have this new definition of divorce, and I'll read this because think of this in terms of it's a very tall task for families. A successful divorce in the social science literature is when the adults are able to work through their anger, disappointment, and loss in a timely manner and terminate their spousal relationship with each other, both legally and emotionally, while at the same time retaining or rebuilding their parental alliance with and commitment to their children. A very tall order. And Minnesota families work on this, and many families do it very well, but it's not something that happens overnight. So we have a lot of new processes over the past 30 or 40 years aimed at helping people make decisions for themselves and their families, rather than having courts, strangers, make these decisions. Few of the processes you may be familiar with. Mediation involves, for example, a mediator who doesn't decide anything for people, who often doesn't even express an opinion, but is an expert in conflict resolution and helps parents have structured talks about how they're going to do things for their kids going forward. We have parenting coordinators, parenting consultants is what they're called in Minnesota, who can help parents who are really having a lot of issues about how they're going to parent their kids and can work with them on almost a day-to-day basis as needed. Those parenting coordinators are not empowered to change custody or in any way usurp the power of the court, but they can be very useful if the parties agree to one. If there's an issue on Friday afternoon about parenting time on Saturday, the parenting coordinator may be empowered to just make an on-the-spot decision so people don't need to run back into court on Friday afternoon. Minnesota is especially known for its early neutral evaluation program. We are a national pioneer, and a lot of states are looking to us for this program, and it has been expanded around the state. Early neutral evaluation, at least with respect to child custody, the parents, either with lawyers or without, come in to a room where there are two professional people, male-female team, often a lawyer and a psychologist. And they talk about the kids, and they talk about the case, and they talk about the situation. And then the evaluators huddle, and they make some recommendations based on what they think would be good for the kids and would be workable for the family. Then the family has a chance, the parents have a chance to talk about it, to see what makes sense. They settle a lot of cases, either right then and there or shortly after. Now, people don't have to agree to anything. It's not a coercive process, and it's a confidential process. But it's very helpful to a lot of parents, and it prevents them from going on to court and gives them a chance to try out some of these ideas and practice something that they might incorporate into a court order. So new processes all the time, but they're generally all aimed at keeping families in the driver's seat for decision-making and helping them make plans that they can live with long-term. This is just a little bit about the ADR, which is the Alternative Dispute Resolution Continuum, and if you have a chance to look at it, you can see that people often start out on the side of a lot more autonomy for them, decision-making power, but some families have trouble with that, and they can't reach decisions, or there's ongoing issues that I'm going to talk about. And they may need a court, ultimately, to make a decision. But we didn't used to have all these processes available. With the new processes came new language, and we used to talk about, as I mentioned, visitation of kids. And, of course, this bothered people. If you're a parent, we think of visitation like, you know, at funerals, and we think of visitation at prisons. And for a parent to visit his or her, and often it was his own child, was really not what we were getting at in terms of public policy in Minnesota. So we moved to the use of parenting time. Often we will see parenting agreements where the custody labels aren't even used. People will say on-duty or off-duty parent. They're both parents all the time, but one's on-duty at some days and the other one the other days. That doesn't work for everybody, and I've provided the parenting plan statute for you. And you can see that at some level, sometimes there does need to be a legal designation of those custodial titles, but they're really downplayed in those. And the idea is that you work out, you put up a big calendar on the wall, and go through it and look at the kids' schedules and the parents' schedules, and you figure out what's going to work day to day, because the logistics of this are often what's really challenging. We talked to parents about having a business plan. That their new business is raising their kids. They're no longer married. They're not in a romantic relationship, but they are partners in a sense, and they need agreements going forward for how things are going to work. They need a way to resolve differences and some planning around that. And that works for some, but not all families. So I want to move on to some of those families. This is a quick list of parenting arrangements, just to give you an overview of the kinds of things that happen. Some parents do what we call co-parenting. That could be a very equal timeshare kind of arrangement. It might be much less time with one parent, but both parents are really involved in making decisions about the kids and working with the kids and are very present in their lives. So it's not always a function of time, but involvement. Parallel parenting is when parents may have difficulty dealing with each other that continues after the divorce. It's not uncommon, but happens sometimes. But they're both good parents. They both have a lot to offer the kids. And what they need is an agreement that's really tightly structured. Who's going to have the kids when? What's going to happen if somebody's sick? What's going to happen if it's a holiday? All of these things spelled out. And they can execute that quite well, but with very little contact with each other. Supervised exchange occurs sometimes with parents who, whenever they see each other, they get into conflict. And so sometimes people will have a child picked up and dropped off at a grandparent's house or at the church, or sometimes you see it at the police station or at McDonald's or wherever is going to work for that family, so that there isn't an opportunity for the parents to have disputes in front of the kids. On some occasions, we'll see supervised access. This is for situations where there has been abuse or there has been substance abuse or there's some concern about the safety of the kids. Courts don't like to do supervised access, but they will do it, you know, based on the facts presented. Sometimes people will agree to it for a period of time as well. It's extremely rare, in my experience in family court, to have a no-contact order. There can be sometimes temporary periods of time where people don't have any contact with their kids, but certainly if a child is going to be traumatized, if there's been serious abuse, incest, something like that, it's a possibility. Contrary to what you may see on TV, most parents actually work things out at divorce. This is not easy for parents to do always, but they really do, and parents want the best for their kids. I've never had anybody come in as a practicing attorney and have them say, I really want to make sure my kids are harmed by this divorce. It just doesn't happen. Parents need just to understand sometimes what is going to be good for the kids, and they do throw themselves into trying to work things out. But most parents do agree on parenting arrangements. As you can see on this slide, the little red slice are judicial decisions in family law cases. So less generally than 5% of cases in family law are decided by a judge. Almost everything gets settled. Now, about half of those cases that get settled, there's really no contest. The parents, although it's difficult for them, work something out fairly easily. The other half is more of a struggle for some of the families, but they work it through, and they eventually come up with some agreements. After divorce, most families are able to cooperate at some level with each other, the parents. One study showed about 25% of parents ease into co-parenting relationship. Another 50% certainly disengage, aren't talking to each other as much, certainly, after the divorce. But over a period of time, a year or two, ease into a more comfortable parenting relationship. And these are folks who, when the grandchildren are born, can both be there at the wedding, can sit at the same table. These kinds of things can happen for these families. But about 25%, and you see different estimates, 10 to 25% of divorcing couples remain at odds, really have conflict going on for a long period of time, for years. So I want to talk about them in just a minute. Now, some parents, and this is great for kids when this can happen, can really co-parent. They can have shared residence agreements, which we might think of sometimes as joint physical custody, where they're really sharing, the child has two homes and can go back and forth in between. There's a schedule for it. They spend a lot of time together. Some recent research out of Australia talking about, so who's able to do this? Because everybody isn't able to do this. It's great for kids when it can happen. And they're finding in these studies that parents who successfully do this really shared parenting with two homes have to really be committed to making it work. They're people who volunteer to do it. They're really committed to all the logistical challenges. You know, they need to live nearby. They need to, resolve all of those kinds of issues. They also have to be pretty flexible and responsive. So when unexpected things happen, they can take care of those. They need to have a somewhat supportive relationship. Okay, take a question here.
Professor, yeah.
Yes.
Representative Mahoney has a question.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I've read that study, the Australian study, and I really want to make it clear that even in the study, it talks about being a very small sample.
Oh, yes.
And in the study, the presentation of the study to the person who led the study, it was pretty clear that it was paid for by a group that was looking for an outcome, and she struggled against getting that outcome, it sounded like, but it still came out to me in that presentation that it was a small study.
Well, I'm referring to the work of Professor Jennifer McIntosh from Australia, and there's a couple new studies out. There aren't a lot of studies on this. This was one of the first ones out. So I share, obviously, concerns about, and with all social science, you want to look at the sample, you want to look at the size, you want to look at all this. We don't take it on face value. I think I'm presenting it because I think that there's some common sense to it as well, and to raise the issues of who does it work for, who doesn't it work for. So.
And my only follow-up, Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, my only comment was that it's a very small study group.
I mean, yep.
They didn't have a pool of 100,000.
Right.
They had a small study group.
Mm-hmm. And it's a couple of studies, and it's in Australia. So, anyway, they found that, this kind of shared parenting with the double residences, also there were more issues with younger preschooler kids and infants. So, anyway, some beginning research about who things work for.
Representative Hortman to this issue.
Mr. Chair, it's not to that issue. It is to the issue of there's a member of the audience taping us, and the camera is frequently pointed at me or in my general direction, and I find it to be very distracting. In the past at the House of Representatives, we have not had members of the audience taping or filming. We've allowed them to publicly use the footage that's put online. And I find it disruptive, and I would hope that we could have that person stop taping.
point well made. Whoever's videoing in the audience, if you could use the public record that is being created right now for your record, and we'd ask you to put the camera away at this point. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one last point about research, and that is, you know, it's the social science literature is vast, and there are lots of different studies, and I think that, you know, an important aspect of that is that it's what's going to work for individual families. And you can read all the studies, and it may not tell you, you know, with a couple in front of a judge, what's going to work for them or not work for them. It just gives us some general information for policy making.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Hoberg.
Thank you. If I might, you carved out the preschoolers and infants. Just very briefly, what was the finding relative to those age groups?
And these, once again, are generalizations. And it depends on how people set things up. The issue with very young children is that they need more frequent contact often with parents. They don't, this puts it simplistically, but they don't remember as well. and so it's good for them to have frequent contact with both parents. Especially with infants, there's some ideas in the literature that it's good for them to sleep often in the same place at night, just because they're learning to stay asleep and all those kinds of things. So that's more about the residents, not that they should not have contact with both parents when that's safe and appropriate. So, and with preschoolers also, just that they, you know, they're still regulating themselves and their schedules a little bit. But by school age, you know, that picture changes quite a bit. Individual kids, of course, are different too.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm.
So, and there certainly is also research pointing to the idea that what we're, and I think one of the goals here really that everybody has, that I think probably everybody in this room shares, is for kids to have the best possible relationship with both parents. And the research supports that that's not necessarily tied to a particular arrangement, you know, how many minutes you spend with each parent, but rather is what's the best way to support those relationships. Most parents end up designing arrangements that work for them, but they all look a little bit different. And I mentioned about putting up the calendar and parents, you know, looking at the schedules of the kids and where they need to be and their work schedules. There's a lot of things that parents take into account when they're designing these arrangements. The ages of the kids, do they live near each other, work schedules. Some people can't afford to have two residences big enough to house the kids all the time. Special needs, blended families, there's all kinds of things that go on. And they also change over time because very young kids will have quite a different arrangement with parenting than older kids. Want to talk for just a minute about high conflict families. And there are that, remember that 10 to 25% of families where there's continuing, ongoing, pretty high level conflict that takes place. And a lot of concern about these families. Now, these may involve domestic violence and some kind of substance abuse, various different kinds of things. And they have ongoing problems often for years and difficulty for their kids for years. And I think psychologists and social workers and everybody struggle to try and work on ways to help those families cope better. But they do exist, and, you know, certainly not the majority of parents, but enough that in making policy we want to really think about that. Lots of different ways that parents have ongoing conflict, from undisclosed domestic violence to people who are just so focused on the dispute with the other parent that the kids get in the middle. So there's lots of different ways that this can come out. My point is that these high conflict families, lumping them as a group, have some special needs. For one thing, our court system is not set up to identify them in a very regular or usual manner. There is no place where they come in and get screened for violence or substance abuse or whatever. And so it would be fabulous if we could identify these families early on, get them some help, work with them, and involve them in solving some of the issues. Is there some treatment that's necessary? Is there some trust that needs to be rebuilt? Are kids traumatized? What can we do to heal that and help those relationships be as strong as they can be? But that, you know, the court system struggles with that, and we see different court systems around the United States trying to do what they call triage programs to do some screening with people. These families often need different processes. Processes like mediation may work for them, but may not, may be dangerous for them. They may not be ready for it. And often these families end up using a lot of court time and may need somebody else to make a decision and to make it be pretty stringent. They also need different custody arrangements. These folks are not good candidates for shared care, co-parenting kinds of arrangements. And they can really be harmful and dangerous for the kids. That doesn't mean they shouldn't have contact. If we can be done safely and without trauma, that may happen, but in a supervised visitation setting, for example. Some research by Janet Johnston, very little research actually out there, you would think, about false allegations and about how many allegations of abuse and substance abuse there are. And these also are small studies. There's just not a lot out there. But overall, in the literature, those of us who work in the field have been surprised at the amount of domestic violence alleged. Generally speaking, most of those allegations are subsequently somehow supported. That doesn't mean the others aren't true. Everyone admits, of course, that there's possibility of false allegations. A lot of domestic violence comes out at the time of divorce. It's a reason that people get divorced. Anyway, I throw these in as emerging research on this. My point being that all of families are different, and families who are in this high conflict group, there are different reasons, they have different needs, and we need to attend to those. You've probably seen some of the literature on domestic violence. Certainly has a strong impact on kids in a lot of different ways. In about half the homes where there's domestic violence, the kids are also physically abused. Kids are affected differently. Domestic violence is not a one-size-fits-all either. It's a big span of behaviors, an issue for another day, but we're learning a lot more about that, too.
We don't have the 12 hours.
No, we'll bypass that one. And I know, mindful of time here, I'm going to flip through some of these slides. These are just pointing out different families, different ages of kids have different needs in terms of how they structure their relationships. I want to talk here, as I conclude, about presumptions. Presumptions basically limit judicial discretion. That's what they do. They make assumptions about things. They come in different forms. It's an interesting role issue, which we won't go into today in terms of the legislature and the courts, and lots of fascinating history in Minnesota and family law between the legislature and the Supreme Court on some of these issues. We have some parenting presumptions in Minnesota law already, a rebuttable presumption of 25% parenting time. So generally speaking, each parent is presumed that they should have at least 25% parenting time. Of course, a lot of parents have more than that. A presumption that joint legal custody is in the best interest of kids if it's requested by one of the parents. That's different than physical custody. And some presumptions around domestic abuse that joint legal or physical custody are not in the best interest of kids if there's been domestic violence. Around the United States, we see a real continuum about these presumptions, and they range. Many states have no presumption for or against joint physical custody, and Minnesota generally falls in that category, that parents are free to choose joint physical custody if they want to. Courts can order it, but nobody is required to have it. Some states encourage courts to consider joint physical custody arrangements. Some create a preference for it, but don't go so far as to say you automatically get it in any way. There's just statutory language about it. Some states have a presumption that joint physical custody is in the best interest of kids in situations where the parents ask for it, where they agree to it. Then the court has less discretion to say no. And a few have rebuttable presumptions that joint physical custody is in the best interest of kids. Those don't go to 50-50 time. Generally, they are something less or more vague in terms of not really saying that it's an amount of time, but it's an approach that they want the court to assume. So a big range across the United States on this and very little agreement. Basically, joint physical custody presumption means that the court wouldn't look specifically at the best interests of each child in each case, that they would assume that joint physical custody would be the thing that would be best for all kids. And if somebody doesn't want to have that happen, the parent who doesn't want that to happen would need to object.
We've got a question from Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is it possible to get, is it compiled anywhere, how many states have each of those presumptions and which ones? Because that would be helpful.
Right. There was a task force 2 years ago. I was a reporter for the task force that compiled a lot of that and certainly could provide that report, had an appendix with that. That research is a year and a half old now, but probably not changed a lot.
Is that information you have easily accessible?
Yes, I could forward it to you.
Could you do that?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. It's an interesting report, and it expresses a lot of different viewpoints about this, and I think it's really important for people to think widely about it. Okay. Just a couple more points on joint physical custody, and I'll wrap up here. Some interesting drafting questions when these joint physical custody presumption statutes come forward. Sometimes they're not linked to time spent, and it's basically presuming that it's in the best interest of kids for kids to spend time with both parents. Others of them go up to, 50-50 time, and people are counting the days and the nights about how that's going to work. Some don't clarify what it is that parents would have to do if there was a presumption to show that it would not be in the best interest of kids. Is there a standard? Is there some kind of evidence? How difficult is that? People aren't sure what would happen with our current 25% parenting presumption. And the question I pose here is, I think it's really important to keep the goals in mind and think about other ways besides presumptions to achieve them. And the concerns specifically that I have about presumptions questions to ask is that they do limit the ability of the court to look at the situations of individual kids. And families are really different, and even the same family is different at different times. And we certainly do have families where kids who would end up in some joint physical custody arrangements would be in homes where there's domestic violence, where there's substance abuse, where there are dangerous situations for them. In order for that not to happen, a parent would have to object, have to have the means to object. It would be helpful to have a lawyer to object. And so the default would certainly be that those kids would go into a joint physical custody kind of sharing arrangement.
Professor Versteeg,
yes.
On that issue, what typically happens to child support under a presumption? And if there's a, let's just say, 50-50 split for the example, does child support still become a big issue, or is it pretty much split down the middle, both parents provide, or is it still based on
net
incomes?
Yep, our law does deal with that. The revision to the income shares law provides for that. We currently have a parenting time credit that people get, but there's a particular calculation. Now, if people's incomes were exactly the same, they might not exchange any child support, but that rarely happens. And it's based on the, if you pool people's incomes, what percentage is attributable to each. Okay. So
So on that matter, though, typically would there be and I think you answered this, but there'd be deductions for parenting time. So if one parent has it 50% but makes twice as much as the other parent, or let's just say makes all the income, requirement for paying would be reduced by half, percentage.
Yeah, and it's a I have to pull out the statute always to get the exact calculation, but yes, there it is it's taken into account in our child support law how much time people spend.
Sure.
And it goes up to certain percentages, 12% to 40 something, which I can't remember exactly what it is, and then you get into a different calculation, but it would not obviate child support payments.
Right. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if you could clarify for me, if current law takes into account parenting time, I assume that's parenting time that's ordered, not parenting time that actually happens.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So in the event parenting time that's ordered is 40%, but the actual parenting time is 50%, that's not reflected in the child support, correct?
Right.
And the same is the other way around. If 50% time is ordered, but one parent isn't taking that 50%, but they're really taking 40 or 30,
right,
child support does not reflect that either.
Right.
Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
So anyway, these are questions I would raise about joint physical custody presumptions, depending upon how they're defined. And I think that people share the goals of having both parents be the best parents they can be and be involved with kids when that's safe. The question is, how do we get there? And there are some families for whom it's not going to be safe and it's really not going to work. And I'm troubled by just saying, oh, we'll say that it doesn't apply to them. When we don't have a method of identifying who they are or what's going on, and they're frankly not always in a good position to raise that. So it's kind of an issue of you know, there are pros and cons each way, but who's best able to, you know, put forward the needs of kids, especially if it's really kids in high-risk situations. And so I worry about having presumptions about those kids that they're not able to do much with, and we're relying on that objecting parent to put that forward.
On that point, would you have any recommendations, or are you aware of any ideas out there of what is used at times or could be used to try to identify those situations? Right now you've got the judge. Is it
most of these families never go before a judge, and most of these cases are getting settled. And there are states, Connecticut is a prime example, where they have instituted a screening program, and they're looking for families who have high conflict situations or substance abuse or domestic violence or whatever it might be early on. And so they're saying to those folks, you know, maybe it's not the best thing for you to go into some alternative dispute resolution process. Maybe we need to refer you to a community counselor or whatever to work out some of these issues. Or they pick up people who, for example, are really interested in co-parenting and doing shared parenting, but they really don't have the skills to do that at this point. And they can be referred to a community group that would help them get to that place where they could really do it, whatever their goals are. So it's a more individual approach to helping families get where they want to go. And then they can pull people out where there's really risk to kids and if there needs to be involvement of child protection or whatever. And other states are going that way. Interesting research out of Connecticut, and it's actually been quite cost effective in these times of fiscal issues as well.
So. Representative Scott has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Professor, for being here today. And I enjoyed the symposium that was last Friday. I got to stay for most of it, so thank you for that. There's a continual reference here, or not continual, but a reference going back to most of the cases being settled out of court before they ever reach the judge. And I'm just wondering, to what effect do you believe that these out-of-court settlements are influenced by the limitations in the law and by the known court dispositions that, you know, and we're actually doing a study here. Mm-hmm. We know of a study where most of these cases, 70 to 80% of them default to the custody going to the mom in most of the cases. And I think a lot of fathers go in just feeling that they don't stand a chance. So I just wonder if you could address if that issue.
Certainly settlements are made in the shadow of the law, as we say, and what the law says is important and sets important public policy. People certainly have different impressions going in, and I'm always discouraged by the idea that a parent would just be so not trusting in our court system or whatever as to give up on that. You know, I don't know the extent to which that happens. I think what the law says is important, and I think that cuts both ways. And what I search for is a way that we can have kind of a happy medium where we can encourage those parents who want and are capable of doing extensive co-parenting to do that and to make that really available and let them know they can do that. But at the same time, for those parents for whom it's really not appropriate and would be harmful to kids, signal to them that they don't need to do that, that it's not an expectation, and that if it's really not going to work for them, they shouldn't do it. And we don't want kids going off with a parent who's been drinking, and we don't want kids in those situations. And so the messages go both ways. And that's why the best interest of the child, you know, as difficult as it can be and as controversial as it is kind of neutral that way. It's saying, well, let's just look at the needs of each child. I certainly understand historically that fathers were disadvantaged in Minnesota in terms of custodial arrangements. I see lots of change happening with that. I don't know in individual cases if people aren't getting what they ought to have. I know that the judges that I talk to spend a lot of time and deliberate hard on these cases. So I don't. The response, I guess, is that, yeah, what the law says is important. It does shape some of the discussions that people have. And part of it, I know the discussion is kind of setting that starting point. But I would just say there are ways to create that expectation that both parents are going to be involved, I think, without looping in some of these families that are really vulnerable.
Professor, I think you're close to the end. What I think I'll do is let you finish your presentation, and then what did you say?
I'm finished.
Oh, you are done.
Yep.
Oh, okay. Then we can go to questions. We've got two others at least. Members, we probably have about another 10, 12 minutes we could ask questions if you have, and then we'll move on. But Representative Wardlow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think Representative Scott largely addressed my concerns, but just make a comment that I think, well, obviously, settlement discussions, mediation, whatever kind of settlement procedure you're going through are going to be affected directly by what the law is, and in fact that sets up the entire thing, that sets up the contours of the settlement process. So wouldn't setting a rebuttable presumption in favor of joint physical custody at least set things out on an even level at the beginning and send a signal that both parents need to be involved in the mediation, and then those other factors you're talking about would certainly come into play as well.
And that's the appealing part, is you know, we've changed our societal expectations about parenting after divorce, that both parents are going to be involved. I understand that. I'm just saying that the cost is high in terms of those kids for whom it's really not going to work. In mediation, for example, I worked as a mediator for a few years. We would literally set up the calendar and say, okay, Bobby has to be here, Janie has to be there, so-and-so works this many hours and these times, and you'd fashion this whole thing, frankly, with no discussion of anything but what's good for the kids, what's going to work for the family, and not using the titles. And pretty soon you'd have a picture of what was going to work and with the contact for the kids because of people's work schedules and where they live and their particular things their kids are involved in. And then you can look at it and say, is this looking like somebody's really got more time or not? And the law requires that you put some labels on it. But in my experience, for most parents trying to work out an agreement, the label is kind of the last thing that gets attached. And it's really about logistically what's going to work. People have such complicated lives, and kids need to be everywhere, and they got the piano lessons and this and that. And so it's often a problem-solving discussion more than a law-started discussion. But clearly, the best interest of the child sets this tone of what's going to be good for these kids. And it's different in every family.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I've got a couple of questions going back to the your conversations about Connecticut, and I've been more in relationship to the high conflict.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in Connecticut, you say they kind of better, I don't know if there's a better term, I'm sure there is, but weed out the high conflict and then bring them into services compromise out and provide the services that they need to make sure that they work. The other part to what you spoke to or what I heard on the Connecticut model was that they go into this type of a counseling. My question is it if both parents agree, or is it if only one parent agrees to... So, or one parent says, I want joint physical custody, the other says no. Mm-hmm. The courts send them over to this counseling to try to figure out if joint physical custody works. Is that the case where only one, or do both have to agree?
Let me back up because so I can explain a little
sure.
bit more clearly or my understanding of it. And I'm happy to provide you with some information on Connecticut.
That'd be great.
You're getting off the top of my head here. Basically, they have an intake and screening triage process
mm-hmm.
where the court personnel are identifying if there are families that have these other issues going on. Okay, and at that point, referrals are made to community resources or whatever. The court can't provide all of these things. They're not funded to do all that. But they're advising families about their recommendations for, you know, you might benefit from mediation. This is what it is. What do you think? There's a big dispute in the field about should these screeners be channeling people to places. I'm in the informed consent group where I say give families good information, give them lots of information that's relevant to them, and they'll generally make pretty good decisions. They're referring people then to different dispute resolution services, so those people and those court people are not making decisions or recommendations for families. They're not. Due process concerns are big with me, and they're not the judge. Their decision can't be appealed. And so they may recommend to people try mediation or try early neutral evaluation, or you know, you may just want a judge to make a decision here.
And Mr. Chair, that actually kind of covers my second question, because my second question was about the cost of such, and it essentially is the divorcing family's dime is spent on that particular part, yeah, as needed.
On the services, yeah. Yes. Although I believe they have some court-connected services there, I could yeah. check into that more. But that's a big issue for everybody. They're finding, though, I believe the preliminary results when I talked to their researchers, which have not been published yet, are that they are finding some savings because some families, you know, use a lot of resources going through the system. They go to some processes that don't work for them. They're very expensive evaluations. And to get people to kind of where they need to be in terms of the process earlier on, helps them get what they need, allows the system to put resources into those families and not into the families who didn't need all that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Mahoney. Professor Versteeg, we don't have any other questions at the committee, and we're also, I think, at the time we need to move to our next testifier. I want to thank you so much for coming in on a short notice. And I assume you'd be a resource to the committee or members if they have particular questions. Is that
absolutely
possible?
I'm happy to visit with anybody or provide you with research or information. And
okay. So, members, if you do, we can get you her contact information if that would be helpful, if particularly. That information on those, the numbers that Representative Hillstrom talked about, if you want to just send that to John.
Yes.
When you have a chance.
I'd be happy to.
Then the next week or so would be great. So,
okay. All right.
Thank you so much. Members, next, Molly Olson from the Center of Parental Responsibility will give about a 15 or 20 minute presentation. I'm going to suggest we hold questions till the end. Ms. Olson, if you want to do your presentation. And then, members, if you have questions, do mark them down. I want to encourage you to ask questions, but just let's let her get through her presentation. Write down your question, and then we'll open it up at the end. So, Ms. Olson, if you can identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Committee Chair and members. My name is Molly Olson, and I live in Little Canada. I'm the founder of the Center for Parental Responsibility, a nonprofit organization often referred to with the acronym CPR. Our program mission is to remove the obstacles that prevent both parents from being fully and equally involved in the lives of their children. We are a 100% volunteer organization with no paid staff. We're a grassroots group mobilizing people in Minnesota and across the country who've been negatively affected by family court to offer research, education, and support, as well as guidance on how to expose the problems of what is occurring in family court and offer education and information about the impact of these problems on children and how to fix it. I represent thousands and thousands and thousands of dads from Minnesota who are quick to say and even quicker to show that family court is not working. Like Professor Versteeg, our previous speaker, I also was selected to be on the 2008 Joint Physical Custody Study Group, which was legislated in the spring of 2008 to study some of these issues. I started getting involved in these issues in the year 2000, going on 12 years now. the more a person talks about these issues, the more you realize how many people are having trouble with the current family court system. Most of the people that come to CPR are financially, emotionally, mentally, and even spiritually crushed by this system called family court, and they are in survival mode. The people I represent are the quintessential average Joe. They are the high school graduates who are the car mechanics, the bus drivers, the sheet metal workers, the construction workers, the factory workers, the postal workers. And yes, there are those that contact CPR that are college-educated accountants, engineers, nurses, and more. I don't work with the rich healthcare executive or the quintessential questionable car mogul or the bankers just trying to get out of their child support. I don't work with those who abuse their children. I don't work with those who are deadbeat dads. Everyone I work with has one thing in common. They care first and foremost about their children, and they want to be the best dad they can possibly be. And they want to provide the care and nurturing that their children need to help create healthy, well-balanced adults that will be the children that run our country, will be the adults who run our country in the future. People that come to CPR are hardcore Democrats who trust the government to take care of them. They are staunch Republicans who believe the government is getting in the way. We have people from every political extreme and everything in between in our organization. So there is no question that the problems in family court are very real and they are a nonpartisan issue. The battle has become a battle not between liberals and conservatives. The battle for change in family law is between people who profit from the current conflict divorce industry, who thrive on this conflict created by the status quo, instead of working to reduce that conflict. CPR is full of affected fathers, second spouses, paternal grandmothers, paternal grandfathers who know what's going on, aunts, uncles, endless other family members, and a growing number of people that come to CPR are the adult children of divorce who have been deprived of their father, and they're finding out why. It's not because their fathers didn't want them, love them, care for them, or want to be involved in their lives. It's because they couldn't, because of the current family court system. That is not working. It may appear that according to the statutes it's working. It may appear according to, you know, the way the policies are supposed to be working, that it should be working just smoothly and great. But I'm telling you, it is not working. Who am I and why do I do this? I am originally from Willmar, Minnesota. I graduated from Concordia College, Moorhead, Minnesota, with a major in communications and religion. I also have my master's degree in business communication from the University of St. Thomas here in St. Paul. What's my day job? Not this. This is a 100% volunteer thing that I do in my spare time. My real job, I'm a consultant and trainer for businesses. I work with corporations that help their employees confront conflict in a way that will enhance the relationship, not destroy it. But what's happening in family court is relationships are getting destroyed. I was first married in 1991. I was divorced in 1990. I had no children at the time, and frankly, the D word was never part of my vocabulary. But it is now. I was single for 17 years. 3 years ago, I was remarried. My husband and I have no children, only because I'm 50 years old and too old to bear children. Why did I get involved in all of this then? In the year 2000, I had two male cousins and one male friend who were going through family court all at the same time. All three cases involved dads who were ready, willing, and able to take full parenting responsibility. And all of them had a huge extended family that wanted to participate in the lives of these children as well. All of them were fully capable. My new husband has a daughter who is about to turn 21. All four of these cases are completely settled. There's nothing that can be done. No change in the law will ever affect any of these cases that originally got me started in all of this. But now, since then, after 10 years, now 12 years, as I said before, thousands and thousands and thousands of dads have come to CPR, as well as the grandparents and the adult children of divorce, saying, please, please, please do something to change what's going on. There's a huge crisis in this country, and it's called fatherlessness. This crisis of fatherlessness is reported in books, in legal publications, in psychology journals, in newspapers, in magazines, even like Newsweek and Time and People magazine. These sort of topics are becoming frequent topics on TV shows like Dr. Phil, or even Judge Judy had so many cases where she couldn't believe what was happening to fathers. She spoke out about this on Larry King Live. I mean, it's all over. The fatherlessness crisis is occurring in your neighborhood and mine. And it's all because of what we believe, and our experience shows, is unwarranted court-forced fatherlessness, stripping children of fit, loving fathers who are ready, willing, and able to take responsibility for their children. I don't need to get into all the history of divorce because Nancy did a nice job of it, the previous speaker, talking about how in the 70s there was no-fault divorce. And that was 40 years ago when women did not go to college. Very few women went to college. Very few women worked outside the home. In 40 years, things have completely changed. But what hasn't changed is how we handle children in divorce. Now we have still the no-fault divorce, however you feel about that, right, wrong, or indifferent, we have no-fault divorce, but we have fault-based custody decisions that linger for no reason at all. And what is supposed to happen in family court is not happening well in family court at all. I talk to judges on a fairly regular basis. I have over the last 10 years many judges who say they don't even like family court. They don't want to be dealing with these issues. And as our previous speaker mentioned, less than 5%, our records show 1% of judges are even making these decisions. So what is happening in family court still? Judges have to make these decisions. And yes, the conversation that went on before is the current law is influencing the agreements. But here are some live examples of what's happening in family court right now. In Glenwood, Minnesota, July 2009, a father filed a petition for custody and parenting time. Mom, shortly after Dad filed his petition, moved from Lincoln County and eventually settled in Pope County. So her attorney filed a change in venue with the court to move the case. And at the venue hearing, and because Mom had all but removed the then 3-year-old child from the dad, Dad had been actively helping to raise this child from birth, despite not being married to the mom. And the judge ordered the parties to enter into a stipulation to provide parenting time, so that a temporary order could be issued. The temporary order was issued, and the dad was coerced into an extremely limited parenting time schedule, less than 10%, because he was unmarried with no legal rights. Unmarried fathers have no legal rights. Well, then that was the temporary hearing. The dad still had hope that maybe when he gets to the final hearing, he'll be able to provide the evidence of what an active, involved father he really was. So he appeals this and goes to the next hearing. Well, he did not have an attorney. Mom had an attorney, and Mom's attorney and her said that unless the dad agreed to continue this 10% schedule, that they would make sure that he never saw the child. Planted that fear in them right before going into trial. That's a felony. I mean, it's a felony, 609.626, to conceal a minor child from the child's parent, where it's intentional to deprive them. It's a felony, and yet this is the kind of thing that is influencing these settlements that we've been talking about. Now today, this girl is 5 years old, and she still, after a year and a half, has no final order for her father, who is still just fighting for 25% time, and the joint physical custody is on the table because he wants to and is able to and could have that time with her. Another case, a recent case in Sauk Rapids, Minnesota. This decision actually came out this past Friday, January 21st. The story is, Mom comes home last fall fall 2010. Tells dad she's leaving the marriage and moving herself and their two children, a 10-year-old girl and a 4-year-old boy, into an apartment down the road, but still in Sauk Rapids. Dad stays in the family home where the children were raised. Mom files a dissolution proceeding on November 5th, 2010 in Foley, Minnesota, Benton County. And there's a judge assigned to the case. A temporary hearing is held on December 2nd. Immediately prior to the issuance of the temporary order from the court, the parents are sharing the parenting time of the children equally on an every other week basis. But then the court issues a temporary order giving the dad every other weekend parenting time, which, by the way, is only 17%. The facts of the case are that mom works at Walmart, where she has to be at work at 7 a.m., so she leaves at 6:30. Dad leaves as a UPS driver, and he leaves for work at 7. But the judge, in his decision, says that mom gets custody because of dad's work schedule. It makes no sense. These are the kind of examples that are occurring every day in the court system. On top of it, when the dad went back to court and asked if he could at least have his statutory allowed 25% time, the judge came back with his decision, and this was the one this past Friday, that said no, he couldn't have his 25% minimum time, and he had to pay the mom $500 for her attorney fees because it was considered a frivolous motion. Then we've heard about the best interest criteria and how wonderful these best interest criteria are in really customizing plans for children, what's right for children. The best interest criteria really is a violation of the rule of law because they're so vague and they're so subjective that nobody can ever know what to do to keep your children or what to do to prevent your children from getting taken away. That's a violation of the rule of law if you don't know how to what to even do. Well, here's a court case that came out October 30th, 2009, using these so-called best interest criteria. This isn't an actual judge's order. One of the 13 best interest criteria, I'll just read off several of them, is, well, first of all, I don't know how many of you are married. I didn't do a survey before I came, but imagine yourself, if you're married or even if you're divorced, imagine yourself the respondent here, okay? The judge says primary caretaker. Petitioner is the primary caretaker. No facts, no evidence, no details, just says petitioner is the primary caretaker. Intimacy of the relationship, another one of the 13 best interest criteria. The judge says, while each parent has a close relationship with the child, petitioner has the more intimate relationship with the child. No details, no evidence, no nothing. Just is. Interaction of child. Judge says, each parent has interacted, but petitioner has done so more. No evidence, no facts. Another one of the best interest criteria, capacity to raise the child. The judge says, while each parent has the capacity to raise the child, clearly petitioner is in a better position to do so. No information, no facts, no evidence, no nothing. Another one of the 13 best interest criteria in this case, ability of parents to cooperate. Judge says, there are no obvious problems in the ability of the parents to cooperate. However, it is also obvious that there is not much communication, as petitioner did not know that respondent had moved in with his brother and no longer lived with his parents. That's it. Dispute resolution methods. Presumably the parties can resolve disputes involving the child. Another best interest criteria. Detriment to child from sole custody. Judge says there would be no detriment to the child if the petitioner had sole physical custody. Therefore, the order, parenting time. The father, in this case, will become the non-custodial parent and should receive significant and liberal visitation privileges. That's the order. That's the kind of orders the court system is giving. No reason whatsoever, but not allowing for two fit parents to take equal responsibility for their children. Then on top of it, a person gets an order like this, and then they face what this next person faces. I got this email actually just this past Monday, so I'm just going to read it. It's referring an article to an article that was in the paper last week. Where to start here? As you may recall, in my husband's case, he has been back in court multiple times, all with the same referee in Ramsey County, because his ex refused to follow the visitation order. And despite the referees always siding with my husband on issues surrounding the court order of visitation, which the mother would only briefly follow, there have been zero consequences for her, the custodial mother, as a result of this. And I believe that in any conflicted divorce, regardless of having joint physical custody, if one parent is determined to use the kids against the ex, the joint custody will mean absolutely nothing, because the courts aren't enforcing the time. That is her point here. They have been going on 16 months of not seeing the kids, because even though the court orders have always been in favor of the father in this case for seeing the children, the courts do nothing to enforce it when the custodial mother will not allow the father to see the children. I just tried to sum that up for you based on the time here that we have. I know we have a limited amount of time. We've also done a lot of research in the court system and found that there are many judges that don't even know about the current 25% in statute, and many attorneys that are not even bringing that up for the parents. So what we're saying is that a presumption of joint physical custody and equal shared parenting is going to put everybody on an equal playing field. It's going to start everybody on the same common ground so that fit, loving parents will not be isolated from their children and children won't be isolated from their parents. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Olson. Representative Hillstrom has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any others?
You stated that currently lawyers are not telling and not bringing up what's in current law, and that many judges don't know what's in current law on the 25%.
Yes, I'm not saying that all judges don't, or that all attorneys don't bring that up, but there are those that don't.
Okay, so Mr. Chair, so then my question would be, if that's current law and it's not currently being brought up, what makes you think that changing the law would make those people bring up that law any more than what's current law?
Ms. Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Having a presumption of joint physical custody, equal shared parenting in the statute is going to change the entire mentality of how we look at families, how we look at unmarried families. The 25% was a token, a bone, really, thrown to fathers several years back, and it wasn't even enough to even make a difference in the whole legal system, because we were at the every other weekend, Wednesday nights for a couple hours doesn't count. It only counts for overnights. But with the vacation in the summer, that comes to 17% time. So the presumption jumped to 25% time, which wasn't even enough to change the way people do business, so to speak.
Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Olson, thank you for your presentation. You brought up a point that I think needs a little more light shown on it over time here. I've heard quite a bit about grandparents being basically excised from their grandchildren's life. Can you expand on that point you made a little more?
Ms. Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, more and more I get calls from grandparents. I know right now there's grandparents that are here that were aware that this hearing was taking place and have attended this hearing and are sitting right behind me today. They are torn to pieces. They have little to no contact with their grandchildren, and it can happen to anyone. It can happen to any of you. What happens is when a dad is relegated to every other weekend, or even the 25% time, which is not much more than that, when a dad is relegated to the every other weekend and there's no enforcement for that time, those parents are those grandparents are shut out. Because, okay, first of all, if the dad gets 4 days a month, every other weekend is 4 days a month, that dad is going to want to have as much of that time with him, as those children, as he possibly can. And yes, that those dads typically want those children to know their grandparents and be exposed to their grandparents, but there's not enough time to go around with everybody either. And those grandparents, what the grandparents say to me repeatedly over and over is, I cannot believe this is happening in America. And there are grandparents who can't even attend volleyball matches with their kids because the custodial parent doesn't want them there.
Ms. Olson, if I can expand on that, what do you mean they don't want them there? The gymnasium's a big place. Is there a legal scenario where they don't have the right to go there, or it's just to avoid that conflict of scornful faces back and forth? Or can you just expand on that a little more?
Yes, I will. Excuse me. There's so many issues regarding all of these family law problems that are occurring, and this, of course, this particular example is something, if I could turn my head, I could see if the parents that are particularly involved in that situation, the grandparents, are here. But one of the topics we have not gotten into also is parental alienation. Parental alienation is a very, very real problem in the whole course of family law, and some of that ties into the high conflict families, and that allows one parent to have veto power on how much anybody else sees those children. So the example that I gave about the volleyball, that particular custodial mother had so poisoned that child that her telling her that the whole entire side of the paternal family was so bad that granddaughter ran up to those grandparents at that volleyball match and basically said, my mom says that you can't be here and I don't want to be here because it makes her mad and it makes her upset and then it makes me upset and I can't perform at my volleyball game.
Okay.
One example.
Sure. Thank you. Any other questions, members? Oh, Representative Simon, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You were on the list.
Ms. Olson, you had mentioned some studies or some analysis that CPR has done. I don't know whether you did it or whether your organization did it or whether an affiliated group, but can you make that available to the committee? I say that, and I'm going to ask the professor the same thing for the thing she cited, because I think we're probably going to be dealing with these issues quite a bit this session, so I think that would help.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, yes, I would definitely like to make that available to everybody. What I'll just briefly to tell you, when I was on the task force or the study group, the Joint Physical Custody Study Group in 2008, there were 11 people on that committee who had previously testified against joint physical custody. There were only two of us that were on that committee that were in support of joint physical custody. So I believe that the outcome of that report was bias. But one of the things that came out of there is that there just isn't enough information. We just don't know what's really going on in family court. So fortunately, I had a volunteer from CPR that came and said he was willing to help spearhead getting the information that they said didn't exist or couldn't be found. So we did that research. This particular volunteer did the majority of it, has spent hundreds of hours in the last couple of years gathering this information to find out in 7 different counties what exactly is the outcome in these counties for the label and the time. And it's been very, very intriguing. And yes, I can provide that information to the committee. It would be, I'd love for the opportunity to even spend 10 minutes explaining that research at some point. But yes, we can make that available.
Representative Simon? Representative Mahoney?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Olson, and I want to compliment you. You have You were there when we put the 25% in, and I have watched as you've followed this issue, promoted this issue, fought for this issue over the last, boy, it seems like it's been 8 years.
12.
And I, too, you know, to back up your conversations or your statements about the judges and the lawyers, they don't know that it's there. And in many cases, having talked to off the record, the judges have not been so silly, but some of the lawyers have basically said, we don't care. It's not going to be, we're not going to follow it, we're not going to bring it up, and we're going to fight it. I've always found that very, very disheartening, and it's been one of those moments where I actually worked hard at restraint. It's a good lesson to learn, you know, restraint. But and as to Representative Simon's request for that study, I know it's not entirely completed. It's not, you know, in the form of the studies. I have seen some preliminaries on it, and it is relatively shocking as to the seven counties that you you went into. And I know that there were law students that helped you with that. So it is not. I want the committee to understand that although law is complicated, it's not that complicated, but it was not just lay people out there. These were second and third year law students that were doing internships going through some of this and finding those that information. So when you do are able to share it with the committee, I hope the committee gives it as much weight as it can.
Thank you, Representative Mahoney, Committee Chair. One other thing I might add, if I could, is the whole idea of false allegations of domestic abuse have come up. And as an organization, I mentioned earlier that we do not support any father who would abuse anybody. But the false allegations are very, very real. And there, I do have with me an article from the March 2008 bench and bar from a lawyer from Minneapolis that wrote about the very real issue and rampant issue of false allegations in family court. I make this available to anybody as well.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you clarify for me what the differences are when you talk about this issue? False allegation, is that an allegation that someone says happened and then is proven that it didn't happen, or is that where someone says it happened and then they say the person recants? Or I'm just trying to figure out what category of folks fall in the false allegation category.
Ms. Olson.
Mr. Chair Westrom and Representative Hillstrom, yes, thank you for asking about that clarification. Everything that I've seen in the literature on false allegations only includes those that were proven to be false, and not those where someone recanted. And because the recanting thing is something that is a concern in domestic violence, that real victims of domestic violence sometimes do that. And that would not qualify under the whole area of concern in false allegations.
Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I want to thank Molly Olson, too. I worked with her back when I was in the legislature, back when. So you've done great work. But, you know, on this issue of do judges actually enforce the laws as they are written, is it possible, do we have any representatives of the court, Mr. Chair, that can come and answer questions? I mean, this is a perennial issue. And, you know, what is the problem? Why, and I'd love to hear some responses from perhaps, one of the judicial districts, if we could. I don't know if we can, but.
Ms. Olson, do you have any response and to that question? We can make an inquiry to the judiciary mm-hmm. and see if there's anybody, in the audience that hears that question. That,
Mr. Chair. I can tell you as an attorney who practices in district court that everything is legal in district court until the Court of Appeals says otherwise. And there are many judges and attorneys who follow that principle.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, may I make a comment?
Ms. Olson.
One thing that I find very disturbing is I have actually been in courts. One of the services and programs that we provide as an organization has been Court Watch, where we're willing to gather volunteers to go in with other fathers in court to give them moral support during their hearings. So I've been to a number of different hearings, and I will never, ever, ever forget the hearing when I sat in Anoka County, and the father's lawyer brought up an appeals court case even, and I'll never forget that district court judge said, "I don't care what the appeals court says. This is my courtroom."
Well, Mr. Chair,
Representative Rumbach,
if it's possible, could we make an inquiry and find out if someone from the Board of Lawyer's Responsibility or somebody could come and just respond? I mean, you know, this is not right.
Sure. I'll have our committee administrator mark that down. Maybe somebody in the audience from one of those agencies can talk to us after the hearing as well. But if we can see what we can find, and if Ms. Olson or if others have that information, Representative Rumbach, if you know of anybody, we certainly would welcome them to the committee and discuss this issue.
Yeah, thank you.
Seeing no further questions, Ms. Olson, I want to thank you for your testimony and your time and helping bring some of your perspectives and concerns to this issue. Members, I do anticipate in about a week or 10 days to probably start some more hearings on some actual bills dealing with family law issues. And so those of you that have interest in that, and just as a committee, take interest in this issue, and that's kind of the roadmap of where we'll be planning to go with this. So. Thank you, Ms. Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Members, I'm going to turn the chair over to Vice Chair Draskowski and then proceed with House File 203. The intent would be to just a brief introduction today, and we'll continue it on Monday and watch for the rest of Monday's agenda. Also, while I probably finish, we'll finish at the witness table. Members, I did put a copy of the committee rules in your packets. Regarding the videotape issue that was raised by Representative Hortman earlier, we've done some preliminary checking with the sergeant's office, and I will follow up with them a little bit further and give more clarification to the committee and to the public Monday on the policy proceeding after today. And so, also, I want to just bring attention to rule number 5 to the public. If you can try to comply with that and get us documents that you're planning to hand out ahead of time, we would ask that as a committee rule. And members, they're in there for your own perusing. We'll also email them out as well. So.
Okay, Representative Westrum, Mr. Chair, do you want to introduce your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I'd like to just briefly talk about House File 203 and then let Mr. Hickey give some testimony. And then I, as I said, plan to, it will run out of time today. But House File 203, ironically, has a number that maybe is fate, or it brings irony at least. This House File 203 is identical to a bill that met the demise of a veto in 2003 by Governor Pawlenty. I don't want to dwell on that too much, but I want to talk about what the purpose of the bill is, what it does, and the history of 2003. We had strong bipartisan support for it then, and I'm hopeful that we can find that same type of bipartisan support, which I have already found with over 35 authors and others continuing to ask me to get on the bill. And so what this bill will do is rein back or bring back appropriately, I think, some legislative oversight to agencies that we have over the years given out, and find ourselves often blaming an agency or a rule and passing it off to an agency or a rule that was ultimately authorized by the legislature. But through rulemaking, the agency goes ahead, and any rule that would cost over $10,000 basically would have to come back to the legislature for approval before it would be implemented and affect our constituents, our job providers, our cities, or groups that are basically affected by rules that would have some unintended consequences. And so I want to bring this bill back up for discussion and see if we can pass it in 2011, which it was passed in the House with about 15 dissenting votes in 2003, and unanimously it passed through the Senate in 2003. And so I think that indicates a strong bipartisan support. Representative Seifert had carried it at the time and worked through several concerns by different groups, and so I've talked to him this since the past month or two, and he suggested that I use the language that was the final version because they had worked out issues and concerns with some of the groups. And so with that, I'd ask Mr. Hickey to offer some testimony, and we can continue the discussion at our next meeting as well.
Okay, Representative Mr. Hickey, before you do, Representative Westrom, we're going to actually take up the bill officially at our next meeting, so we're going to dive a little bit into here into some of the testimony. Members, we're going to adjourn on time today. Since we went over time last time, the goal is to adjourn at 14 after, so Mr. Hickey, we may cut you off, but we'll come back and finish the bill off on Monday.
And Mr. Chair, maybe for the record, we should move the bill. I would move House File 203 be recommended to pass and referred to the Government Operations Committee.
Okay. Chair Representative Westrom moves House File 203 to be recommended to pass and transferred or sent to the Government Ops Committee. Mr. Hickey, please introduce yourself and your affiliation.
Hi, Mr. Chairman. Mike Hickey with the National Federation of Independent Business, and I feel like I'm under a little bit of pressure here at 214, but hopefully I can wrap it up. I want to thank Representative Westrom for bringing this bill forward. We've tried to deal, us, NFIB and other groups have tried to deal with this issue of administrative rules that have the force and effect of law for many years, and we've had a hard time trying to come up with the silver bullet that hopefully can provide a little relief to our members, the small entrepreneurs, but not just the small business, possibly large business, nonprofit organizations, your own individual citizens, people who end up running into rules and having a problem dealing with it. They almost never know about it when you get a contact from somebody. We found out about this. I bet that's how almost any letter or contact you ever get from somebody who's having a negative experience running into rules and regulations. But, for the last several decades, there's been this broad delegation of power by the legislative branch to the executive branch, and the rules and regulations that people complain about and that we're concerned about and this bill deals with is the result of that delegation, and it seems to be just a steady trend of that occurring. We've looked at different things to try to mitigate this problem. There's the Federal Regulatory Flexibility Act you may be aware of. The federal government's pretty dedicated to it. They actually have created an office of advocacy to force the agencies to comply with it. It is a complicated law, though. It would require creating some new government in the form of some kind of an advocate to oversee the law. I don't know if that's the answer for Minnesota this year or any near year soon with our budget problems. There's other legislators have talked to me about trying to review rules, and that was difficult. I think that almost maybe need to be done on a industry by industry basis. A lot of the times the very people, the businesses or individuals affected by that have a hard time differentiating between a rule and a law. And a lot of times it's hard to know where is the law and where is the rules start. They just know they don't like it. They know it's bothering them. They know it's hampering their business or hampering them in their private pursuits, and they don't like it. And so it's hard for them sometimes to differentiate. But I think what is really good about this bill is the simplicity of it. It's we're not dealing with existing rules, but at least new rules. We're going to get the people with election certificates involved reviewing them when it's determined it costs the party $10,000. And, you know, we could possibly talk about where's the best place to draw that line, maybe want to lower it a little, but, at $10,000 is a significant cost to somebody. It's definitely a burden to somebody, and we think there's great justification for you, the people with the election certificates, to review that to see if this is what you really wanted to do, and does the rule really make sense, and the fact that you know it's costing somebody $10,000. So it's a great bill. The simplicity of it, I think, is one of the real salient points of it compared to trying to get into a complicated model based on the Federal Regulatory Flexibility Act, which also can be a good law, but it's complicated. It would require, require the creation of an advocate office or somebody playing that role who cared about it for that to matter. So I think this is just a great bill to try to head off new rules that can really be burdensome to people, and be interesting to see what our experience would be with it, but at least it be reviewed by you, the people with the election certificates, and we just think it's a big plus, and strongly urge you to enact it, and thanks for bringing it forward.
Thank you, Mr. Hickey. Representative Hilty, we got about 2 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't need 2 minutes. Mr. Hickey, I would find it very helpful if by Monday you could come back to the committee with some examples of situations in which, had this law been in effect, the outcome would have been different.
Mr. Hickey?
Representative Hilty, that would be new rules coming up. So, I mean, going back how far? I'm trying to think of the last real controversial rules that came out. I know Governor Plenty, I think, has vetoed a couple. So I'd have to come up with that by Monday. I'll try to ask around and see if I can find some examples in recent time where, if this law had been available, maybe something could have been stopped.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Representative
Mr. Hilton. Hickey, in your testimony, one of the first things you said was a reference to emails and communications from members about this issue, and I'm presuming that if there's, widespread interest, as there obviously is, in implementing this change, there must be something that has happened in the past that would indicate that this would be an appropriate solution to it. So I'd just appreciate if you could come up with a couple of examples of what of the problems that this bill would solve.
Mr. Hickey, if you don't want to respond to Representative Hilty, it sounds like Mr. Hickey's going to do his best and see what he can come up with by Monday. Representative Hortman, you have something real quick?
Real quick, I just think that we should let the PCA and the DNR know about our consideration of this rule before Monday so we can hear from their legislative people, what sorts of things would we catch up here in this? Would it make us unable to do Clean Water Act regulations, Clean Air Act regulations? What kind of situations do they see it applying?
Representative Hortman, point well taken. We'll have staff check into that and communicate with those folks. Members, we're at our deadline. This bill is going to be laid over till Monday. We'll see you then.